Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, understanding the current paradigm and new approaches in the care of patients with ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Ms. Jennifer Phillippe from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center in Boston to discuss nursing considerations for the patient with ovarian cancer. Note that in these programs, we may discuss the use of agents and regimens that are not approved, so check out the prescribing information for more. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can also be found in the program notes. To begin, I asked Ms. Phillippe to provide her perspective on life as an oncology nurse.
I'm in the gynecologic oncology department at Mass General. And I work closely with the medical oncologists. So gyn-onc is a little funny where we have both surgical oncologists that can give chemo as well as, of course, do surgery. And then we have our medical oncologist. And, you know, our job is mostly to give chemo, and we spend a lot more time with patients with recurrent disease. So patients that are getting chemotherapy for a second, third, fourth, et cetera time. And then, you know, we put them on clinical trials as well. My day to day, I mostly see patients for chemotherapy and clinical trial clearance. So, you know, I look at lab results, go over their symptoms with them, and then decide if it's safe or not to proceed with that therapy that day, and decide if there's any dose reductions needed, that kind of thing. I also see a lot of urgent visits. So people that are having complications of their cancer therapy or their cancer in general. So that takes up a lot of my time. And then I, of course, am on the computer a lot answering messages, phone calls, doing prior authorizations with insurance companies, you know, that sort of thing.
Kind of curious, when you look at your job, what are some of the things that you, you know, value the most about your job, the things that you enjoy the most about your work?
I think the first and foremost thing is I really like the people I work with, which, you know, I've been at Mass General for 15 years, actually, in various roles. I started out in clinical research, and then I went back to school, became a nurse, did medical oncology for a while, and then went back to school, got my master's, my nurse practitioner degree. And I've been at our specific gyn-onc clinic for about 8 or 9 years. So I think first and foremost, I love the people I work with. I think we do a really good job taking care of our patients. The other thing I like is our patients. You know, I think, you know, I get the question a lot, isn't it hard? Isn't your job so hard and sad? And how aren't you sad all the time? And I kind of view it differently. You know, I think it's a great opportunity to help patients and their families or loved ones through probably one of the worst times in their lives. So I find it very rewarding at the end of the day. So I think, you know, helping people get through their symptoms, helping them understand why they're getting a certain therapy, or, you know, why their oncologist chose this over that. And just, you know, working with people to make sure that we're on the same page.
Well, maybe as we talk about some of these patients, we might get a little bit more into, you know, kind of what the experience was like taking care of them. But why don't we start out with this 78-year-old patient? Can you talk a little bit about her?
So this is our 78-year-old. She is a retired teacher, and she has a BRCA1 mutated ovarian cancer. I'll go into a little bit about her presentation, like I will with each case. She presented a little bit strangely. She just felt a firmness in her upper abdomen, and then she ended up having some abdominal symptoms like early satiety and a little bit of discomfort in her upper abdomen. Her past medical history was notable for arthritis, osteoporosis, and Raynaud syndrome. So very healthy 78-year-old otherwise. But unfortunately, this presentation then led to further workup, which led to an advanced stage 4 high-grade serous ovarian cancer. So once she was diagnosed, she met one of our surgeons, and that surgeon had decided that she was not operable at that time, which is common. So in this situation, we usually start with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and that usually includes carboplatin plus paclitaxel. After about three cycles, this patient had scans, and the surgeon did decide at that time she could undergo cytoreductive surgery, which was successful. And then we did about three more cycles of chemotherapy after that. During this whole time is when we sort of work people up for germline mutations, somatic mutations, so mutations within the tumor itself. And she was found to have a germline BRCA1 mutation. So this made her eligible for an oral pill, a PARP inhibitor called olaparib. And she started this at the full dose, 300 milligrams twice a day. And she just finished last year. She finished 2 years of treatment, which is a standard treatment for maintenance olaparib in the upfront setting. And I just saw her about a month ago, and she remains in remission. She's feeling great. So it was kind of like a classic BRCA mutated case where someone started out with chemo and ended up on maintenance PARP inhibitor.
So this is a great case that you chose here to really kind of get into some basic issues about ovarian cancer as well as PARP inhibitors. You say she has a germline BRCA mutation, which means potentially her family might be at risk to also have a germline mutation. Did she have other people in her family, or were any of them tested?
Yeah, great point. So that's always something we want to make sure we talk about with our patients. And a lot of times in this setting, we will send them to a genetic counselor just so they can have all the risks explained in thorough detail. This patient had a brother who lived pretty far away. They weren't very close, but she did inform him. I am not sure if he ended up getting tested or not, but yes, men should get tested as well.
Interesting. And did she have any family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer or any kind of cancer?
No, not that we know of. I think her parents died relatively young of cardiovascular type things. So interestingly, there was no history of cancer, which is surprising, right?
Right. And then when did you first meet her? Were you the one who actually was involved in giving her the neoadjuvant chemotherapy?
Yep. So I met her probably, one of her first cycles of chemotherapy. Unfortunately, her husband had recently passed away, and this was like sort of COVID time still. So she was really struggling with supports. She has great friends, but just not a lot of family around at all. And she lived far away from Boston. A lot of people commute a couple hours to get to us, which was hard for her. But yep, I met her pretty early on in her treatment course. So we were able to establish a really good relationship as time went on.
How long had she been married, and what did her husband die from, and what was that like for her?
She had been married, since her 20s. So I don't know, 50 plus years. He died, I believe, of a stroke. So it was pretty sudden, which, is so hard. And she was sort of grappling with that grief. And then she got hit with this diagnosis. So I don't think she ever truly fully grieved her husband. And then she was also grieving sort of the loss of her health at the time and going through this incredibly scary diagnosis.
How did you evaluate her in terms of how she was coping with this? What kind of support system she had? And what did you do to try to sort of help her out in that regard?
Yeah, I think you know, we always want to get our social work team involved with these type of cases, especially just to provide some more insight, and they can kind of spend more time in between visits with these patients as well. But in particular for her, she's a talker. So I spent a lot of time with her just getting to know her, which I think in her case was really important that she knows her team really well. And then I was sort of her go-to person during treatment. So she had my back line, and she would call for this, that, or the other thing. She also interestingly developed a relationship with her, this is going to sound so funny, her insurance nurse manager. So somehow they got connected and they lived close to each other and they sort of became friends. And this nurse would come to her appointments. She would be on the phone with us sometimes. So that was just kind of a funny and odd, but great relationship that came out of this. Especially because, you know, losing her husband, she had to figure out too, like things you don't think about, like house finances. She had never paid the mortgage, you know, things like that. So I think, you know, losing someone and then being hit with this diagnosis and having to navigate all of this can be so hard. So just, you know, being there for the person, truly caring about them, spending a lot of time with them, I think can go a really long way.
How does her clinical presentation compare to other patients you've seen with ovarian cancer? It sounds like it was not too specific. You know, she had some abdominal issues and then, of course, turns out to have this really terrible diagnosis. How does that compare to the typical patient you see?
Yeah, her specific symptoms are a little strange. She's a firmness in her abdomen. She's thin, so I think, you know, a lot of people may not have even noticed that. But a lot of people most often present with very sort of vague symptoms, you know, change in bowel movement habits, constipation, bloating, you know, things that we've all had, you know, from time to time. And, you know, we don't usually rush to our primary care with a little constipation. So, unfortunately, these symptoms kind of go on and on and on. And then people often end up presenting to the emergency room with, you know, big bellies of ascites or shortness of breath with a pleural effusion or bowel obstruction.
And then I guess one of the first decisions was made, it's pretty typical, I guess, for localized ovarian cancer, was whether or not she was operable, and in particular, whether or not she would need systemic treatment or chemotherapy before going to surgery. And I guess in this case, it was determined she had so much disease in her abdomen that it'd be better to treat her first. How did she tolerate the chemotherapy, and how did she feel both in terms of side effects on the chemo, but also did her abdominal symptoms get better?
She actually tolerated chemotherapy really well. And I find most patients actually do. We're so good at tweaking, you know, antiemetics and, you know, hydrating when we need to, that I find we can get almost anyone through chemo. But she, you know, in spite of her age and everything she was going through, she did really well. She did struggle with some anemia. I don't remember if we needed to transfuse her or not, but I think, you know, overall, she did very well and was so pleased to get to surgery.
One of the things that we often look at in ovarian cancer are tumor markers. Did she have an elevation in her CA2729?
She did. Yes. Her CA125 was elevated. I don't remember the exact number, but it came down very nicely, and it's been resting in the low 30s for over 2 years now.
And then how did she tolerate the surgery? What kind of condition was she in post-op?
Yeah, so she had a big surgery, including a splenectomy, and she was admitted for a couple days or maybe up to a week after. But she ended up recovering really well. She had to, of course, meet with infectious disease to get vaccinations post-splenectomy. But really, other than that, she did very well, no big complications at all. And we saw her about 4 or 5 weeks later to restart chemotherapy.
You know, sometimes it seems like the pandemic was some kind of bad dream, but I guess when you look at it, she was in 2021. That's when the vaccine had come out, but there's still lots of concerns and a lot of restrictions in terms of visitors, et cetera. What was it like in general for you during the pandemic, and what was it like specifically taking care of her?
I like your description of it being a bad dream, because that's kind of how I think about it too. I look back and I wonder, how did we do that? How did we get through that? How did our patients do it? For a long time, we didn't allow anyone to come with our patients. We were sort of, you know, in full swing, because our patients, they can't wait for anything, right? This is serious stuff. So, but we did. There was a long period of time where people had to come alone, which was just so horrible. So we tried to make exceptions where we could, and we did our best to communicate with the families afterwards or on the phone. FaceTime was actually a big thing. I had a lot of FaceTime visits where people brought their families in that way. But it was hard. It was really a hard time.
So one of the key issues, as this case sort of demonstrates, in patients with ovarian cancer is, you know, one of the themes in oncology nowadays, which is biomarkers. And in this case, in ovarian cancer, what we're looking for are things like BRCA, germline mutations, or somatic mutations, but also other measures of genomic instability. And most of those patients end up getting a PARP inhibitor, and a lot of them end up getting olaparib, which is what she got. And niraparib is another agent that we'll talk about. I think you have another case of a patient on that. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you think about in patients who are about to begin a PARP inhibitor and some of the things you discuss with them?
First of all, it's like you had mentioned, choosing the PARP inhibitor. We just try to follow the indication. So in her case, because she had a germline mutation in BRCA, she was eligible for olaparib. So we usually try to start the PARP inhibitor, you know, within 4 to 8, maybe weeks after the last chemotherapy. And one of the things I'm looking for is their blood counts. You know, how did they do during chemotherapy? Did they have any super low counts like neutropenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia, especially? And how did they recover? So where are we starting out? Sort of where is our baseline? The other thing I think about a lot is how they tolerated chemo in terms of nausea, fatigue, that sort of thing. You know, are they sort of back on their feet, or did we leave them with a little deconditioning or disability? So I think all those factors are really important to take in consideration when thinking about dosing of the PARP inhibitor. So most often we're trying to give the full dose of the PARP inhibitor, whether it be olaparib or niraparib. We'll talk a little bit about the nuances of niraparib in a little while, but for her, she did have some anemia during treatment, but her labs had recovered really well, so we were able to start her on full dose. The other thing I always, of course, want to go over with my patients is side effects. So yeah, the most common side effects are fatigue, GI upset, and anemia with olaparib. So I do see a lot of nausea at first, but usually within 4 to 6 weeks, this tends to dissipate. So I always want to make sure we have antiemetics on hand at home, whether I have the patient take them beforehand or just sort of as needed. And then we'll want to monitor labs at least once a month with olaparib, just to make sure nothing is, you know, plummeting. and you can consider doing it weekly if, say, the patient really struggled with their bone marrow during treatment with chemotherapy. Sometimes I'll have people come in weekly for labs that way. There are some sort of more rare but unique side effects of olaparib that I always want to mention to people. Pneumonitis, or inflammation of the lungs. I have actually seen this in olaparib, and usually it starts out the patient's a little short of breath, or they have a dry cough, or they come in and we pick up their O2 sat has dropped, that sort of thing. MDS AML is a very low risk, especially in the upfront setting. But of course, we want to be informing our patients of that. And then there was a small risk of venous thromboembolism as well. But I would say most often people tolerate this drug pretty well. Sometimes we do have to do some dose reductions for things like bone marrow toxicity or fatigue. But usually people get through pretty well. And then they come off usually after 2 or 3 years, and then they realize how tired they were during the whole process. But yeah, usually we can get them through without big problems.
How do patients respond when you bring up the issue of reducing the dose? Do they have concerns that maybe that won't be as effective? And how do you respond to that?
Always. They always have that concern, which is so valid, right? So we know that the dose modifications, those doses are also effective. And the other thing I like to point out is that, yeah, you know, we could keep you on the full dose, but you're going to end up having delays. You could end up, you know, in the hospital with a major delay. So it's better to be on a slightly lower dose, sort of steady state, one that you're tolerating, rather than trying to give you full dose, it not working, and have lots of interruptions.
And so it's interesting, you were saying that you've been at Mass General for 15 years. So I guess you were there as PARP inhibitors kind of came on board. I think it was 2018, the first study, which actually looked at olaparib. And then there was another study with the niraparib that we'll talk about, a similar PARP inhibitor as well. What do you say to patients in terms of what the benefit is of treatment? Because as we know, of course, and these patients in particular, the ones who do have these mutations, the chance of recurrence came way, way down. It was very, very dramatic. But still, there were quite a few patients who, in spite of treatment, had a recurrent disease, which really is difficult to treat and really can generally not considered curable. So how do you respond when people ask you about sort of what to expect from the future?
Yes, it was very exciting. I was a relatively new nurse practitioner at that time, but it wasn't lost on me how important, of course, this all was. And I always want to tell my patients that too, right? PARP inhibitors have absolutely changed the landscape of ovarian cancer treatment, especially in people with BRCA mutations. And, you know, I always tell my patients, you know, if this were 10, 15 years ago, we would be having a different conversation. So, and we know, you know, it's not the easiest drug to take. There are, of course, side effects, toxicity, there are risks. But in this case in particular, the benefit outweighs the risk so much. And it's so nice to be able to say that, because I don't think we can say that with a lot of our drugs.
Yeah, I mean, you think about this lady had a lot of disease to start with. It seems pretty unlikely she'd be still cruising along without any recurrence at this point if she hadn't received this treatment. So anything else you want to say about taking care of patients and monitoring them over the 2 years of treatment? And again, as she went through her 2 years of treatment, what did you see? Did you start to see more fatigue? Was she starting to get wear down? Or did she kind of have a fairly normal lifestyle?
Yeah, she definitely got more fatigued, and we did run into some issues with anemia. So we did end up dose reducing her relatively soon, actually, after I'm going to say a couple months after we started. She was just, you know, on the couch all day, which really wasn't her. And you know, maybe a little depression was creeping in too, or lingering, but we couldn't blame it all on that. So we did end up reducing the dose, and she did much, much better after that. You know, she was really afraid of COVID, which is understandable, but she was not spending a lot of time doing things and seeing her friends and whatnot. But we kind of eventually got her out of that funk. And with that one level down dose reduction, she did really well. But she is definitely one of those patients that came off and a couple months later was like, gosh, I didn't realize how tired I was. So she feels great now. She's traveled to visit some friends and recently had great looking scans. Her CO125 is still low. So I'm really crossing my fingers that that continues for her.
It's really a unique opportunity to see people and families and loved ones dealing with usually the greatest crisis of their life. And sometimes, you know, not getting through it, and other times like this, getting through it. How did you see this patient evolving as a person, having gone through this experience? And what was it like for you? What's it been like for you to take care of her?
She was understandably incredibly frightened and almost sort of hesitant to trust the medical profession or our world, which I think is all really understandable. I'm not quite sure if something had happened with her husband or she had had negative experiences in the past, but I think that's where this sort of like nursing relationship comes into play. You know, we were able to spend time with her and create this great relationship where she trusted us and we were able to get her through all of her treatments, I think, because of that. And so that just shows how important human interaction is. And even though it was COVID times, we were able to do it.
Yeah, you know, we every year we go to ONS Congress that you've worked with us so many times on. One of our themes has always been what we call the bond that heals. The idea that
yes,
going beyond whatever anti-cancer therapy you're giving, there's also the relationship that you have with the patient that often they highly value, and it sounds like that was the case here.
Absolutely. I love that. The bond that heals, I think, is just so important. It's not just me. You know, we have a whole team, practice nurses, infusion nurses, the team up on our floor that took care of her. So I think we made her a believer.
So, and you know, there are many others out there, I'm sure. So let's talk about your second case. Now we've gone from 78 years old to 46 years old, mom of three. How did she present? And tell us a little bit about her.
She has three kids, and another sort of strange, actually really strange presentation. She came into the emergency department with symptoms that were mimicking acute appendicitis. She actually did have appendicitis, but the imaging also incidentally found bilateral ovarian masses. And then, you know, throughout the whole workup, she was found to have metastatic disease, including a pleural effusion. So she was quite sick when she presented.
So can you talk a little bit about her workup, what was found as she was worked up? Was she considered operable, or again, she needed neoadjuvant treatment?
She also was not operable at the time of diagnosis. I think we ended up grabbing a biopsy of one of the sites of metastatic disease. We drained her pleural effusion, and she was also started on neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which we do see a lot because, you know, like we were talking about earlier, symptoms are so vague that a lot of times people are presenting with advanced disease. So giving some chemo first can really make that surgery more successful. And then, you know, during her treatment, we did the same thing. We worked her up for germline mutations, somatic mutations. She was HRD negative, BRCA negative. And then she actually got bevacizumab, which we haven't talked about. She got bevacizumab with her upfront treatment. A lot of times we'll use this when people are sort of more high risk or they have ascites in their abdomen or big pleural effusions, because it can really help dry those up and also gives a good option for maintenance therapy at the end of upfront treatment.
So you mentioned the fact that she did not have any of these mutations that make people more sensitive to PARP inhibitors, but she actually ended up receiving a PARP inhibitor, niraparib, and niraparib was studied in a separate study, and it's hard to indirectly compare to olaparib, but it looked very active, just like olaparib in patients who had BRCA mutations or these other signs of HR deficiency. But also niraparib was thought to have some benefit in patients who didn't have these abnormalities and ended up getting approved. And I guess because of the issue she had with bevacizumab, that was a good choice for her. Can you talk a little bit about niraparib? It is also a PARP inhibitor, so a lot of the similar benefits that you see to what you were saying about olaparib, but you know, maybe slightly different in terms of the patient experience. What are some of the things that you think about in patients like her going on niraparib?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, you're absolutely right. This patient probably would have continued on bevacizumab had she not had such profound side effects on that. She had such significant nosebleeds that she had to go to the emergency room several times. It required packing. We had to get ENT involved. And then she had really hard to control hypertension. I think we had her on 3 or 4 antihypertensive agents. I just don't think it was safe to continue her on this. And that's where the sort of patient, physician, patient, nurse relationship comes in again. And you want to have sort of patient led conversations, patient centered conversations. So, niraparib, the other PARP inhibitor, that we'll be talking about today, can be given in the upfront maintenance setting for patients that don't have a BRCA mutation, so no germline mutation and no somatic or HRD mutation. And you're right, it does not work as well as olaparib for BRCA mutated population patients. We don't give a lot of this, honestly, in the upfront setting because of that, especially when bevacizumab is another option. But in her case, she wanted to be proactive. She wanted to try to do something to prolong the response that she just had from platinum-based chemotherapy. So after a discussion with her about risks and all of that, she did decide to start the niraparib.
And what were some of the things you discussed with her? I'm sure a lot of them were similar to what you say to patients with olaparib in terms of, you know, why it was being given and in particular, what kind of side effects might occur.
Yes. So with niraparib, same sort of side effects as olaparib, except for we do see a lot more hematologic toxicity. So, we definitely want to make sure that we are taking people in for labs once a week, at least for the first month, because a lot of times we'll see the thrombocytopenia and it can be quite severe within that time frame. And then with niraparib as well, for the dosing at first, the FDA dose approved dose starting dose is 300 milligrams once a day instead of twice a day with olaparib. So that's kind of nice. But this is just for patients over a certain weight who have platelets over a certain amount. So if they're below, I think it's 170 pounds, or their platelets are below 150, we'll do an upfront dose reduction to 200 milligrams once a day. And they found sort of during the trials that this really helped with the heme toxicity. Another quick thing about her is that we put her in surgical menopause. So she was also sort of going through all of these side effects as well. And it's something we kind of don't think about, like right off the bat. We're thinking about chemo and saving lives and all this stuff, but she really, really struggled with surgical menopause symptoms, which can be quite severe compared to a natural menopause. She had hot flashes, insomnia, she was all achy. So we ended up putting her on some estrogen for that, which really helped.
That's really interesting. You don't usually think about it because a lot of these patients are postmenopausal. They've already been through menopause.
Exactly.
So she actually started out at the lower dose of 200, and was she able to maintain that, or did that need to be reduced further?
Actually, I think we were able to start her out at 300, but eventually, the fatigue and thrombocytopenia got the best of her. So we did dose reduce to 200, and she's been okay on that. Or she had been okay on that. Unfortunately, she came off this treatment recently, but yeah, she did okay with the dose reduction. Yeah.
How long was she on treatment?
Not very long. I want to say maybe 7 or 8 months. So
And
just
then.
sort of in that platinum sensitive-ish realm of recurrence. Yeah.
And then what happened? How did she present with in terms of recurrence?
It was picked up on the CA125 started to creep up, and then we did some scans shortly after that, and it did show some disease recurrence. I think she had pelvic lymphadenopathy. And so we started her on carboplatin, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And she is on that currently. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about her life situation? You mentioned her kids, if she has a partner, and how they fit into the whole picture, so to speak.
Yeah, so this patient suffered with anxiety and depression before all of this. So of course, a lot of times a diagnosis like this makes all of that so much worse. Not to mention she's a mom of three. She's trying to raise her children, one of who has severe autism, nonverbal. And she stays home because of that. So her husband's supportive, but he's the breadwinner, right? So he's, always working and working overtime to try to support their family. And she's the one at home, which, caregiver fatigue. I can't imagine the struggles she has, but she's just this wonderful mom. And I can't imagine. My heart always goes out to her because she has questions like, what's going to happen to my daughter when I die? And who has to answer that question? That's so awful. And then they came from the Midwest too, so they really don't have a lot of support around here. Massachusetts does a good job of caring for children with autism, but of course she's like the main sort of person, and she's going through chemotherapy, and she has a surgical menopause symptom. So I don't know how she does it. She's an amazing person.
So we talked about using PARP inhibitors, particularly in these patients with BRCA mutations and similar mutations. But also, you mentioned bevacizumab, which is used a lot in ovarian cancer. And in some cases, a PARP inhibitor, specifically olaparib, because it's been tested combined with bevacizumab, is often used. When you are in that situation where the patient's going to get both a PARP inhibitor, again, usually olaparib and bev, how does that sort of complicate the issue in terms of following the patient and the kind of side effects that develop?
Yeah, great question. So oftentimes we give that combination olaparib plus bevacizumab, again in the upfront maintenance setting for patients with HRD positive tumor types. So same sort of counseling with the PARP inhibitor, and then you have to add on all the bevacizumab side effects, which can be anywhere from very mild to this patient's case quite severe. Mostly with what I see with bevacizumab is sort of like headaches, nasal congestion, voice changes. You can get some nosebleeds, usually not that severe where you're going to the emergency room. but it does happen. I do see some sort of body aches. And then, of course, the high blood pressure, which occurs quite frequently. So I want to make sure that my patients have a blood pressure cuff at home just to make sure. I don't usually make them start out taking their blood pressure at home, but say they come in and their blood pressure is slightly elevated, I may have them start taking it at home a couple times a week just to make sure it's not like just because they're in clinic and are anxious or have sat in traffic for an hour. And then it's also important to note that it can cause delayed wound healing. So inevitably, someone needs to have some dental procedure, you know, during this time. So we just want to make sure they give us a heads up so we can hold treatment, you know, for the proper amount of time around that procedure.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your third case, a 72-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Yes. So she is a lovely social worker with, unfortunately, someone with a platinum refractory advanced ovarian cancer. So in her case, she was seen for postmenopausal bleeding and eventually ended up with a pelvic MRI, which showed a mass, some ascites, lymphadenopathy. And then very quickly, symptoms progressed, abdominal distension, fullness, discomfort. Those are kind of the symptoms we see often when people present. Her past medical history includes type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. Those were all well controlled. And she also suffers from depression and anxiety, but has a very stable psychiatrist in the community that has really helped her for, I think, over 20 years. They've been seeing each other.
And can you talk about sort of how she was initially treated and then what happened?
Yep. So she is another one. I guess I have all neoadjuvant patients today. Another one that received chemotherapy first. And then we got CT imaging after three cycles, as we usually do. And incidentally, she had a new pulmonary embolism. So this is really unfortunate. You know, I don't think she would have been a candidate for surgery anyway, but a new embolic event would, you can't give surgery anytime soon after that. So we put her on apixaban and got that all controlled, ended up giving her three more cycles. But unfortunately, scans only showed minimal improvement in her disease. Her CA125 had not normalized, which is another thing we look for. So at that time, we did something that we do sometimes in this situation. You know, she was tolerating treatment okay. Maybe we could get her another two cycles. Maybe things would shrink a little more. Maybe at that time we could do surgery. She was up for it, so we did do two more cycles. So in total, she had eight cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel. But unfortunately, after those two cycles, she still had this sort of mixed response. And now her CA125 was increasing. She had new liver mets, so she was definitely not a surgical candidate. Luckily, around this time, trastuzumab deruxtecan was kind of coming out for the ovarian cancer and solid tumor population, and we tested her tumor for HER2, and she was 3+, so she had a positive HER2 status, so we were able to start trastuzumab deruxtecan.
And can you talk a little bit about what trastuzumab deruxtecan is, how you explain it to patients, and what are some of the issues that come up in managing people who are receiving this treatment?
Yeah, absolutely. So trastuzumab deruxtecan is a antibody drug conjugate. So these are sort of like the latest and greatest thing in oncology right now. And they're all different kinds of them. This particular one is targeting HER2 on cancer cells, but ADCs are all comprised of three parts. So you have the antibody, which sort of acts as a GPS, locating that receptor on the cancer cells. You have the linker, which links the antibody to the chemotherapy. And then you have the chemotherapy or the kill or what sort of gets injected into the tumor cell. And then usually there's a bystander effect. So I always like to tell people, you know, even though each cancer cell may not have that protein overexpression, nearby cancer cells will be affected as well by this drug. I will say when this first came out, we were a little bit humbled. It can be quite toxic to people. I saw a lot of low blood cell counts, a lot of fatigue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. But I think, you know, once we kind of finessed it, we're much better at starting people on an appropriate dose and getting people through. We do antiemetics, of course, before the infusion, and then we start people on olanzapine at night for 5 nights following each treatment, and then we do dexamethasone too for a couple mornings afterwards. And then, of course, we'll want for them to have some ondansetron at home and some lorazepam just for any breakthrough nausea. And I always make people buy Imodium too with this one.
So, you know, as you mentioned, these antibody drug conjugates are designed to try to deliver chemotherapy, really, but deliver it mainly to the cancer cells. But unfortunately, there is some that also affects normal cells. You mentioned some of the acute GI type problems that can occur. But another issue with this drug, and of course, this is developed in breast cancer, and they have had, the greatest experience with it up to now, even though right now it's approved for any patient who has a tumor that's HER2 positive. But of course, one of the things that was observed early on here was interstitial lung disease. You referred to that a little bit earlier because it rarely can also occur with PARP inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, interstitial lung disease, how you explain it to patients, and what you do to try to sort of prevent the patient from running into problems by picking it up earlier?
Yeah, of course. So this is all about education. Another patient of mine, she came in and had been completely fine. And then she came in for treatment. And I could just tell by the way she was talking, something wasn't right. She was kind of breathy. She had a dry cough. And then her O2 sat was like in the high 80s all of a sudden. And I'm like, what's going on? You know, why didn't you call us? She's like, I was kind of out walking my dog this morning and I realized it was hard to get to the mailbox. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, head slap. But I think it had come on pretty quick. I had just seen her a couple of weeks earlier, but this is all about education. So, and all about being available too. So I always want to tell patients any change at all, the silliest thing you might think is going on, I want to know about it. And usually with this, people get a little bit breathy, short of breath even maybe, and they have a dry cough at first. So, just educating them a lot. And then asking them every time they're in any breathing symptoms and just reminding them that this can happen.
So, you know, I think the breast cancer people are very proactive about doing imaging on people with the idea of trying to pick up some of these changes that occur before the patient gets symptomatic. Because if you can diagnose it at that point, you know, grade one, which is you have changes on imaging, but the patient doesn't have any symptoms, you can hold the drug, you can give corticosteroids, and then once they get better, you can actually retreat them. But usually if they get to the point where they have symptoms, like the patient you described, they're not going to be able to get treatment any further. Can you talk a little bit more about how she did and what happened with her tumor as she was being treated?
Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder how often the breast people image their patients. We do, you know, every 3 months as standard, but I wonder if they're doing any more than that. But anyway, this particular patient had to be admitted to the hospital and we had to start IV steroids right away. She was able to be discharged after a couple of days on oral steroids. We did a prolonged taper and she did recover beautifully. She has a completely normal looking CT chest right now. But unfortunately, kind of like you had said, this is a higher grade pneumonitis. So I don't think she'll be getting any sort of ADC in the future. And we did not restart her.
So getting back to your 72-year-old patient there who got the TDXD, what happened to her tumor as she was being treated?
So this is such a success story. her CA125 started to go down immediately. Her symptoms got better almost immediately. And she has been on this treatment for over a year now with platinum refractory disease with a normal CA125. You can still see her tumors, her cancer on scans, but they have shrunk. There nothing new is popping up. So this is just sort of like a remarkable story. And she has had some side effects, some fatigue, which has sort of gotten worse over time. Occasionally she's anemic. We've had to give her a blood transfusion here and there. She does struggle with a lot of brain fog, chemo brain, as a lot of people call it. But really, all in all, she's done beautifully. We did recently do a dose reduction of the trastuzumab deruxtecan. So hopefully that will help her symptoms a little bit.
It's really interesting. We were just at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting, and we actually did an entire program there on HER2-positive gynecologic cancers. And as part of doing that, I went out and did videos, Zoom interviews with a number of community-based gynecologic oncologists, and I asked them about their experience with T-DXd. And of course, the last time I did it, nobody'd even used it because it's, fairly new to the field. And then this time, everybody had used it, at least a couple of times. The word had gotten out. And it was really amazing to hear them describe the cases because it reminded me of maybe, I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago when it came out in breast cancer. And then I started asking people in the community, have you used T-DXd? And then they would describe these patients who had no other options, who went from being really sick, sometimes hospice bound, to feeling great. And it was just like almost you could see the euphoria in the faces of the people who were presenting the cases. And I kind of got that same feeling as you were talking about her. It must be an amazing experience to look at a patient who typically would just have a terrible downward course who all of a sudden gets better, so to speak. What was that like for you and the team?
Absolutely. It's such a amazing feeling, when you do all the clinical trials and the slog of all of that, and then things like this come out and they work, and it gives people hope and a longer life, and it's just the best sort of. That's another reason I like this field and sort of what I do. You were asking earlier. I think the science and the new advancements are just so exciting.
Yeah, when you think about it too, in terms of participating in clinical research, I know that's a big interest of yours and a lot of people at academic centers, of course, are doing the trials. And, in the past, a lot of times, the patients were doing it really to benefit future patients because they'd be in a trial that's comparing a couple of things that are already available and see which one is better. But nowadays, we see so many new agents. We're not even talking about there's another sort of targeted therapy out there, mirvetuximab, which is another antibody drug conjugate that's used that also developed. But, if you think about it, even before it gets to practice, there are people who participated in those trials and they benefited by being in the trial because they got treated with an agent that they wouldn't be able to get outside of a trial. And,
Absolutely.
you see a lot of patients nowadays who actually benefit themselves from being in trials, particularly of new agents.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I always try to let people know that when we're considering a clinical trial, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what they're getting into, or maybe they've heard sort of negative things, or maybe they think it's sort of end of life. But I try to explain, we've had a lot of FDA approvals of the trials that we've done recently. So who's to say, that person isn't going to get an active drug?
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Ms. Phillippe, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update, understanding the current paradigm and new approaches in the care of patients with ovarian cancer.